This is Fully Vested, a weekly podcast where Jason Rowley and Graham Peck discuss technology and venture capital investing. This week, we discuss open source software development and how it has changed the technology landscape, and review the annual SaaS Benchmarks report produced by OpenView Partners. You can learn more at fullyvested.co.
Hey, Graham, how are you doing this morning?
I'm doing well. What time zone are you in?
Well, I'm here in Chicago. I'm just looking out at the beautiful Chicago skyline, and I for whatever reason thought the word morning came out when I really meant afternoon.
Well, good morning.
Yeah, salutations to you too. Let's see, is my gain up a little? Yeah, okay, I think I got this all figured out now. Graham, we have some stuff to talk about.
We do. I'm very excited for our show this week.
Me too. This should be a good one. But before we get to that, should we explain a little bit about who we are and kind of what we're doing here?
I think that'd be a good idea.
Okay.
So my name is Graham Peck. I'm a venture partner with Cultivation Capital, which is a Midwest and now bi-coastal investing firm that invests in early stage companies in life sciences, ag tech, and I specifically work on our software technology funds. In addition to that, I work with some offshore partners to help startups and enterprise companies and anything in between build their technology teams and do staff aug work. My illustrious co-host is
Jason Rowley. Hey, everybody. My name is Jason. I write things on the internet for Crunchbase News about startups and venture capital and the data sort of connected and emanating, from those subject areas. And then when I'm not doing that, I also help in a volunteer capacity, the Python Software Foundation find and recruit early stage startups to give them a free booth space at PyCon US. Which actually, Graham, is a fantastic little segue into what we're going to be discussing today. We have a bunch of fun. We have two fun subjects to talk about. The first is we're going to be, well, we can do this in any order, but a subject that we're going to discuss is the recent SaaS metrics report published by a Boston-based venture firm called OpenView Partners. Which is they call themselves an expansion stage venture firm, and they've been producing this incredibly thorough report for several years now. So we're going to discuss the 2019 version of that, and then we're also going to discuss a blog post published up on the website of Andreessen Horowitz, which is, for anybody who's been living under a rock the last decade, one of the larger investment firms in Silicon Valley, backed a whole bunch of different companies of varying degrees of success. And they wrote a post about the business of open source software, which is highly germane to some of the volunteer work that I do. So I'm excited to dig into whichever one you want to dig into first, Graham.
Oh, well, let's go OSS, open source software first.
Yeah, let's.
So in your work with the Python Software Foundation, what are your thoughts about the OSS movement as a whole? I mean, obviously, Python is a huge cornerstone there.
It is.
My question is broadly, what do you think about open source software?
Oh, so I am a big, big fan and daily user of many, many different open source software tools. So I write a lot of very janky code using a library called Pandas, which is an open source data science framework built using Python. Which is itself a open source programming language. and I use Jupyter Notebooks, which are to do my data analysis work for the day job. I use Jupyter Notebooks, which are really great interactive programming environments that you can use for doing some like really granular code execution and like debugging. That's my primary use case for it. But anyways, like I've been a major fan of open source tools for a really long time. And one of the things that I've sort of come upon in the past is like, there's a really great tool, but it doesn't have any, it either lacks community support or even if there is a reasonably strong community of users around it, sometimes there isn't a business model that corresponds to it. And that just means that, you know, the really great software that people such as myself, you know, incorporate into their day-to-day workflows, sometimes that gets abandoned or becomes unavailable or whatever. And that really sucks. And so that's why I'm really excited to get a little bit of insight from, you know, from the folks at Andreessen Horowitz. I think specifically this was done by Peter Levine and Jennifer Lee on how to create a more sustainable business model for projects that are either built on top of or are the sort of where the main tool is a piece of open source software. So that was a little bit of a yammering, rambling explanation, Graham. But
well, I think one of the things that's interesting is that open source software, you know, is probably used by a lot of people on a daily basis, and many of them don't even know that they're using it. So that's one of the other things that I think is probably true is that even a casual, you know, user of a lot of popular websites or technology programs who aren't developers, who aren't angel investors, this really impacts everyone who uses technology in almost every way in today's world. And that's one of the things that I think is really exciting is how pervasive, you know, open source software is.
Well, and the reason why is it's because it allows you to sort of build on, you know, build on the shoulders of giants, so to speak. And that allow, I mean, it allows software developers the opportunity to also have, you know, greater to be able to spend time focusing on the stuff that they really need to focus on, right? Like, you don't need to necessarily rewrite, you know, write a brand new proprietary database solution for absolutely every development project. You know,
One of the things that from an investing standpoint, you know, is really exciting about the open source software movement is that it allows our companies to go further and accomplish a lot more with using a lot less. Now, over time, they may need to rewrite things individually for their own mm-hmm. optimization at different scale. But to your exact point, our companies, rather than because of, I guess, a combination of open source software and also cloud computing infrastructure, you know, if you were going to start a company, even probably 10 or more years ago, but certainly 15 to 20 or more years ago, probably the first thing you would do is spend 6 to 7 figures on physical infrastructure and have to have multiple people. Even the smallest of technology projects would have needed to have at least 2 or 3 infrastructure administrators who weren't necessarily contributing to the specific code of the project. They were just making that code possible by managing the infrastructure that it lived on. And you and I, or anyone else out there, probably someone more developer-y and more technical than you or me, but could start a project with a few dollars in an Amazon AWS or similar account on Azure or Google or any one of several other cloud providers, you know, in today's world, and spend a little bit in microtransactions and have the same things available to them. So the barrier to entry of new ideas, I think, has been lowered so dramatically by both cloud computing infrastructure and open source software.
Right. And it to your earlier point about it allows companies to go further. It also allows developers to go further. So, you know, there's now many different, you know, relatively standardized stacks of, you know, of open source software. So you might use, I don't have an example off the top of my head, but, you know, you might use, you know, React as your front end framework. You might use, you know, Mongo as your, or MongoDB as your database solution. You might use any, you know, any number of other, different open source components, but, you know, they get standard, these get standardized into, you know, into software stacks that allow developers to, you know, who've been incredibly successful at one company to get onboarded into a new team, perhaps, you know, within their same company or at a different company, that as long as they're using, you know, the same basic stack, like there isn't that same sort of process of needing to spin yourself up on a whole brand new way of doing things. You know, when there is this sort of modularity introduced by open source software.
You know, and I think one of the biggest things that is talked about several times throughout this article is how companies across all sizes, from the tiniest startup up to some of the biggest companies on the planet, are also really embracing this trend in today's world. And I don't want to jump ahead. If you want to go through some additional detail on the kind of open source 0.0, 1.0, 2.0 kind of world, but, you know, in 2001, Microsoft CEO Steve Ballmer was quoted as saying that Linux was a cancer, and now even Microsoft is using open source software. And yes, near the end of the article, which of course will include a link to
links in the show notes.
You know, it notes that that Google has over 2,000 different open source projects, and Airbnb, which we've talked about frequently on this show before, has more than 30 open source projects of their own. So it's really great to see, you know, how much the community of companies, large and small, embraces this. I mean, I know specifically I've worked with many startups and invested in many startups. In fact, I would say we invest in very few startups that don't use open source technology in the process of developing their own software, probably almost never anymore.
Right. Because there's no need to reinvent the wheel. So before we get into the sort of like modern business of open source, let's go through a little bit of the history. Peter Levine and Jennifer Lee did a really good job of summarizing the sort of various eras in the open source software, not exactly life cycle, but the development, you know, how we got to today, right? And so in their framing, you know, in the really earliest days, it was the free software era. It was like the mid-70s. It was, you know, the stereotypical like grad student, you know, hippie nerds just building stuff and seeing what sticks and making it freely available for other folks to use. But, you know, obviously that may have sort of laid a bunch of different foundations for a lot of the tech that we use today, not that didn't necessarily result in a lot of like businesses or a lot of like technologies that wound up sustaining themselves over the long term. And so while companies were trying to figure out how to make money by writing code that is made available to folks in a reasonably open basis, you know, this sort of brings in the second era, So to your earlier point, referencing Linux, you know, there was the emergence of companies like Red Hat and MySQL and all the rest that would offer their main code base for free, for anybody to be able to use. But, you know, when it came to the process of like actually implementing a setup or tuning an installation or
customizing all the use case or adding, yeah, of course, adding and forking on top of that,
yeah,
to make it useful for whatever your particular instance or again use case was, then I think that's where people began being able to get some really big benefit of standing on the shoulders of the giants, as you said,
right,
before.
Yeah, because like, you know, instead of having, you know, an internal, let's use MySQL as an example, right? So instead of having an internal database administration on your team, you know, do all that configuration. For many companies, you know, back in the day, it made more sense, you know, to say, well, why are we, you know, why have an expert on staff here, you know, and have that be their only job, where we can go directly to the company that makes this software and outsource a little bit of that, you know, configuration and customization process to they go directly to the, you know, straight from the horse's mouth, so to speak.
And in a lot of cases, that probably empowered a lot more people within their organization in the case of a MySQL database. And this is probably common across open source software, but that probably empowered a lot more people to be able to utilize that database for whatever the purposes of it were for that organization as well. So not only do I think they probably got the benefits of, you know, of being able to use MySQL and not having to have their own in-house database administrator. If used properly, their database was probably more freely and readily available to more people inside their organization.
For sure. So, so then, you know, there ushers in this next era, you know, which Lee and Levine have referred to as, you know, the SaaS and open core era, you know, which they triangulate to starting in the mid 2000s. And that's when you started to see, you know, companies that build open source software really start to embrace, you know, the dual trend, you know, or that parallel trend rather, of cloud computing to offer, you know, more and more of their services as like subscription software facilitated through a big cloud computing platform, which they go into some of the potential downsides of this. But you know, as far as the upsides go, you know, they say that it creates a something of a virtuous cycle, you know, wherein company, you know, a company that's using this open source software, you know, will pay a marginal amount for some service or for use or whatever. And then, you know, they become more and more dependent on this tooling, and they end up paying more for more support, or more, you know, services, you know, facilitated by the open source software company. And it in turn just continues to drive demand for this stuff. And or for the, you know, for the software in question, and the company is then able to, you know, parlay that income stream into, you know, developing a more feature complete product, into, you know, improving various aspects of its usability, you know, making proprietary features on top of the stuff that's readily available to community users, et cetera, et cetera. And that sort of gets us to where we're at today with, you know, with the business of open source. And so, Graham, I feel like I've done a lot of talking. Where do you, you know, based on your read of this, what do you think were some of the biggest takeaways about the modern open source software industry and business?
Yeah, I think that, you know, there were two really big things that stood out to me, you know, and one of them was as the article talks about kind of what are some of those business models that are built on top of it. And the main ones that they identify, although they certainly, I think, go far enough to say that these are not the only, you know, available business models, but are what they call RAS, reliability, availability, and security. So these are essentially, you know, add-ons to the core open source product or set of products that that improve its reliability, availability, and security. Again, in many cases, I think those tie in the 2.0 era to some of the cloud computing, cloud infrastructure, AWS, Azure, Google Cloud, and other, you know, publicly available cloud providers. The other models that they identify are tooling or add-ons. Again, you kind of touched on that in the end of what you were saying, where a developer can say, hey, there's this really great other way that this can be used, or this great expansion. And so other people could sell an expansion that stacks on top of an open source library or toolkit. Then there are other broadly available services, which might mean custom development or other things on top of that platform, administration of that platform. So obviously, in going back to your earlier example of a MySQL database, maybe you do still need some additional customization above your team's ability or technical skill to do it. You could certainly hire a dev shop, which had MySQL as one of its core competencies, and they would be able to likely provide that service customization or service or customization for you. And then the final two kind of models that they talk about are performance and auditing. So again, getting additional value out of that open source system. And we've talked in recent weeks about a couple of different platforms that help modernize or monitor, I guess is the better word than modernize, results of things, including one that I know you've worked with closely, Jason, called FOSSA, which is actually, there's a special call out for in the end of this article, thanking their CEO for contributing to the efforts of the article. So, and then I think the other big observation I had, at a high level was there is a comment in here talking about whether valuations would ever be able to compete with all proprietary software companies. And in the early days, I'm not sure where this is in the 0.0, 1.0, 2.0 kind of timeline. And I don't know if they drew that point as they compared those timelines that way. But now there might even be a premium or a benefit in a lot of cases, or certainly valuations are at a minimum on par with all proprietary software. So, looking at it, from the investor perspective, again, I would say that the vast majority, probably all, unless they are trying to reduce the size of their code base for some strategic reason, probably almost if not all of our portfolio companies are using or interacting with open source software or building on top of OSS libraries and in OSS languages. So I think those were a couple of the big kind of takeaways that I had, was looking at what the business models were then thinking about the investment models and then valuation and saying, hey, there was one time when these were thought of as these kind of kooky little add-ons, and now this is really the way that the software technology development world works. And I definitely agree with that and would say that there's certainly no value degradation, from a startup using or building heavily on open source tools, in today's world. We certainly ask what the tech stacks that you use are, but we don't judge more harshly in any way, shape, or form, or drive for any kind of premium if the answer is even mostly open source software.
For sure. So I think an excellent little case example of the difference between, say, an open source product and the commercial, revenue generating product is something like Databricks, which is mentioned a couple of times in the in Andreessen Horowitz's article as an example of like a SaaS type business model. So Databricks has raised a bunch of venture money. In February of this year, they raised $250 million in a Series E round, which valued them at $2.75 billion post-money. And I wrote an article about them for Crunchbase News, and I had an excellent conversation with a gentleman named Michael Franklin, who's the head of the computer science department at the University of Chicago. And I swear to God, I'm going somewhere with this. Before he was at UChicago, he was he ran the AMP Lab at Berkeley. And the AMP Lab is an interdisciplinary but computer science focused lab that produced Apache Spark, which is now just called Spark. And Databricks is sort of the company that came, that emerged from from this open source, you know, freely available software. And, you know, they did so. So Spark, you can think of as the sort of open core of Databricks. And yet Databricks has built a number of different features differentiating itself from just regular old Spark. And there's actually a really great website on, or there's a great page on Databricks' website about the differences between it and Spark, and all of their value add stuff that Databricks offers is stuff like, you know, oh, you get to use the proprietary runtime for Databricks, which allows it to run way, way faster because it's performance optimized. Databricks offers like a managed data lake and an integrated workspace and all this other stuff that just using, you know, the albeit great, you know, command line tools and all the rest that come bundled with a regular old Spark. You know, it just that Databricks offers something extra and above. And so it, again, it's just a case example of the types of services that companies can really monetize around their open source software, that primary offering.
One of the things that I thought was really interesting was how the offers analyzed the way that at least a few, and I'm not sure if Databricks was an example of this, but the way that a few companies have gone about determining if they're going to develop a new feature, whether that goes into into the open source freely available library, or whether that goes into the proprietary paid stack. And that there are some really interesting ways that different companies will often, especially if the company is very close to the core product, as in that case where I think Databricks or another similar example that the article uses, the developers of that for-profit company had also contributed over 10 times as much code to the publicly available free open source library as any other contributors. But I think that the authors do a really good job of describing the way that some companies go about determining what goes, again, in the free product or the free open source library and what goes into the paid library. And they have some suggestions of how to go about making that choice moving forward. And it's about how core that is to the other use cases. And I really thought it was great. They go further into exploring kind of common failure modes. And one of the three common failures that they describe is that that basically the developer community, they talk a lot about building community and why that's so important. Yep. For success in open source software. If you try to commercialize too much, and the developer community that was resonating with your product kind of loses faith because of commercialization efforts, or sees that you're trying to squeeze too much profit out of them, that's one of the three most common killers of open source software projects. And so I thought that those were both really interesting observations, along with the other two ways that those die, in their opinion, which are open source software user doesn't lead to an enterprise buyer. So you could have resonance on a personal level, but you don't end up actually getting, paid for that because there may not be enough value generated in it. So that's almost the other side of the same coin.
I'm going to interrupt.
No, go
you.
Ahead.
Or you're just in a situation where your particular use case does not require the paid version. So, for example, like JupyterLab Jupyter, the project that makes the fantastic Jupyter notebooks and JupyterLab, which I just referenced earlier, there are like, it does offer, managed hosting and better collaboration features available as a paid product. But because I'm the sole sort of data analyst or data science person, whatever you want to call me on our team, I have zero reason to pay for you know, to pay for the paid offering, just because it offers us a feature set that that we can't use right now. So
yeah, so that may be, you know, going back to business models earlier, that might be one of the types of business models in terms of additional tools or performance, or even some of the infrastructure, maybe ability to collaborate. And that's kind of what they're saying in one of these failure modes, is that that basically a lot of times you might get a user or even a small group of users, but that doesn't scale across the enterprise, or a larger business may not have a need for it. And that's not necessarily bad, but it could cause failure of that open source software project, or it certainly would make it, I would think, more difficult to commercialize. Do you see collaboration tools as one of the common additional features to open source?
Yeah, because like if you think about you know, who's using open source software, it's typically software development teams. It's not often, you know, at least in a commercial setting, you know, e.g. a situation where there's likely to be budget allocated for paying for tooling. Those tend to be, you know, slightly larger teams as opposed to just like individual developers or individual data scientists. So yeah, it would make sense that collaboration features, or at least some sort of enhanced like group based management, you know, functionality does become part of a paid offering. Oh, and then I just wanted to issue a minor correction? Yes, I'm going to issue a minor correction, which is that Jupyter itself does not have a paid offering, at least that I'm able to see. However, there are a number of different companies out there that offer paid hosting for Jupyter notebooks and Jupyter Lab programming environments. Sorry, just wanted to real-time follow up there for a second.
No, that's a really good point. And also brings up the, you know, something else that I found interesting from the article was that in a lot of cases, the company that commercializes it and the open source project may be directly linked, but in many cases, they're also decoupled. And the article did a really great job, I thought, of going into some good examples of both and said that companies have been successful in both cases. You basically just have to, again, pay attention to clear delineation of when new features come out, how you decide whether that goes into the open source project or into the paid side of the project. And again, making sure that you don't disenfranchise the additional developer community, since those are, to some extent, your outside salespeople or champions who kind of get the larger community, you know, as a whole to, to get on board. You know, one of the most common tools that I've used that has a huge open source community is WordPress. And I think WordPress and everything, you know, with parent company Automattic, which is one of the companies referenced herein and thanked at the end of the article. I think that they continue to host a substantial portion of the internet. And while
It's like a third of the internet or whatever is like built on WordPress, something like that.
Yeah. And about half of the most popular, blogs, the most popular 100 or so blogs are hosted on WordPress. It also noted, I'm not sure what time frame that reference was, but yeah, I mean, that's the tool. That's probably the open source project or tool that I've had the most close collaboration with. In a prior career, I spent a lot of time building and managing WordPress websites, you know, and that was truly phenomenal, experience to interact with, with that software. And I still do from time to time, and I think what Automattic, the parent company of WordPress, has done, you know, they're, you know, going to be doing a substantial amount of revenue still to this day. They, I think, have done a really good job of building WordPress and then additional tools and companies around it, many of which that they then commercialize and gain revenue from. And they've built a substantial ecosystem in terms of hosting and other kind of ancillary businesses built around them, while the core tool is remains free. And obviously that's great and powers, again, approximately a third of the internet.
Something like that. I mean, so for example, like I've used the open source version of WordPress to build my own website since, gosh, I don't know, 2008. I've been a WordPress user, maybe a little earlier. Anyways, it's been like a decade of me using the open source version, and I do have, I'm self-hosted, so I have an account with one of the big hosting providers. But it's not necessarily WordPress specific hosting. It's just a generic hosting account. But that's neither here nor there. What I think's really great about what Automattic is doing, specifically with its hosted WordPress product, is it allows them to sort of go head to head with organizations like Squarespace or Wix or other website builders that are more enclosed ecosystems, by allowing people who are not necessarily the most technically, I'm not even going to say technically adept, because there's plenty of people that are like incredibly technical, but just like don't want to have to go through the nonsense of like spinning up a new hosting account somewhere, or managing their own server or whatever, or worrying about, all the weird bugs and security holes that occasionally come up.
I have had more than one hacking instance using WordPress, and that's always a nightmare,
me too.
Especially when a particular large provider who I previously used had a permissions kind of spillover on the back end, and rather than one of my WordPress instances being hacked, when they were in a shared hosting environment, all 2 to 3 dozen that I was working on were all hacked instead. That was a particularly good
egregious.
Anyway,
yeah. Oh boy,
but that's not WordPress's fault. They were very clear about where their software began and ended. That was a permissions problem based on a provider I was using.
Yeah, no, I've encountered similar issues in the past, but anyways, this is all just like another example of how. There's different types of users, which actually, Graham, this might be a good transition into the presentation from OpenView. But there's different types of users out there, and some of them are going to be more technical than others. Some of them are going to be more willing to or be excited about really getting into the code and doing their configurations and figuring out all the hosting and figuring out how all this stuff is going to work. And then others just really want to they're much more willing to just like pay
something to host their podcast.
Yeah, sure. Exactly. Although I don't think WordPress.com does a podcast host. Anyways, that doesn't matter. You know what I mean? It's always good to offer, something for money, and it's good to make something available to people who otherwise might not be comfortable using the open source tool by packaging it in something that's nicer and more user friendly for them. So, Graham,
I think to kind of maybe put the cherry on top,
sure,
and as Andreessen Horowitz says in one of the final slides, which we'll include the link in the show notes to find the full presentation from them on this too, because this is an article digesting a presentation that they did. One of the last slides that they show, in fact, the last slide that they show, the headline ends with, "As software eats the world, open source eats software." And I definitely think that that's where that this world is going.
For sure. Because again, everything is built on the shoulders of giants increasingly. And gosh darn it, I'm very popular today, Graham.
Wow.
Anyways, do you want to talk
know
about
how that feels?
No, it's my family. They're in town.
Oh.
And I really want to see me, I think.
Oh wow.
It's high quality problems. Hang on one sec. Let me text this person.
So one of the most common, business models, and you know, as software disruption has happened, obviously has been SaaS or other, other recurrent revenue business models. At Cultivation, we try to invest in our software technology companies nearly exclusively in SaaS or other ARR, MRR driven companies. And so what Jason and I are now going to pick out our kind of key highlights from is, again, as he mentioned, is the 2019 expansion SaaS benchmark report this year prepared by Sean Fanning and Kyle Poyer from OpenView Capital. OpenView Partners, excuse me.
So, Graham, there was a bunch of really interesting trends that I was able to pull out.
So, Jason, what did you find as some of the most interesting high level trends in the report?
I think there was a lot of stuff in here sort of confirmed what might be intuitive, which is that when you are a relatively small company, the amount of energy that it takes to like double in size, or to like, for example, like double your ARR, is much smaller than the amount of energy it takes for a much bigger company to say double its ARR. And so what that means is that over time, as companies grow larger, it seems like it's sort of a rule of just a general rule of thumb that companies become less capital efficient, that they have to spend more money to eke out the same amount of growth on a percentage basis. And this sort of came up in a couple of different slides.
At least one of those is slide 27, which talks about growth rate by company ARR, just for those who might be following along.
Yeah.
And it points out that, good companies or many companies in the report double basically every year, whereas top quartile performers are nearly tripling on a year-over-year basis, especially at those smaller scales. But what the graph on that chart shows is that the bigger the company, the slower the growth rate as a percentage of revenue. And that's probably a not surprising kind of thing. And as you say, that confirms what would be a natural assumption. The bigger you are, the harder it is to grow, in terms of, revenue dollars, right? So the top quartile companies are growing at nearly 50%, even if they're more than 50 million in annually recurrent revenue. That's a really big number, whereas the top quartile performers at the lower end of between 1 and 2.5 million in ARR are nearly tripling. Well, that's probably a not surprising realization, because to triple 1 million in revenue, you only have to grow by, 2 million more. If you're assuming you also have, of course, high retention rates on your existing million.
For sure. And so the slide that I was referencing more was slide 28, which shows that, it's the, they plot the sales and marketing spend as a function of ARR. And it shows that, the amount of money that is, so the median amount of money spent sort of peaks at that 20 to 50 million ARR range. So it looks like a company in the 20 to 50 million ARR range will spend just over 40% of their ARR, or sorry, they will spend that money as a function of their ARR, as opposed to, say, a company with less than $1 million in ARR, which will spend, let's say if you got $1 million in ARR, or $999,000 in ARR, just to make it official, for less than a million, it says that those companies will spend, somewhere around, $300,000 a year on their sales and marketing expenditures. So that was one of them. The other sorts of trends that I thought were were interesting is, again, stuff that sort of makes sense, you know, from like a business intuition standpoint. So slide 39 was really interesting to me because it shows that that it sort of pays to swing for the fences, you know, if you will. So like it makes a lot of sense to sell to, you know, enterprise type clients or very large businesses, because those are the ones that are most likely to result in, you know, very lucrative, you know, long-term value for the company.
I think that those are really great insights. I think a couple of the other things that stuck out to me were I really liked the section on product-led growth, which was very near the beginning. Yes. I think slides approximately 15 through 20. It was a relatively short section, but the main point that it made, and I've had a lot of discussions and experience working closely with a couple of business partners on product-led growth strategy, was that basically product-led growth companies are more expensive and grow more slowly at earlier revenue ranges, but somewhere between 10 and 20 million, they take off, and for lower ongoing expenses, I think have higher growth rates on average than non-product-led growth companies. So that, I think, is a really interesting thing, you know, and I think that a lot of companies could do a lot more to do a more product-led growth strategy because, you know, as I think some of the things in this point out, it's not a complete hard and fast switch, and product-led growth doesn't have to drive absolutely everything you do. But they compare things like free trial offerings, product analytics, self-service buying option, bottom-up sales, product qualified leads, referral programs, dedicated growth, a kind of account executives or some other FTE, and freemium offerings. And all of those things are approximately double what they would be in non-product-led growth companies. So that was one of my big takeaways for those people who are running startups out there, is that it may require a little bit more capital up front, and you may have slightly slower growth rates when you are below somewhere between 10 and 20 million in ARR, but that having a product-led growth strategy will lead to lower long-term costs of sustainability and higher growth rates as your company exceeds that 10 to 20 million in ARR. So that was one of the things that I thought was really interesting. One of the other big insights, and actually the reason that this article was forwarded to me, was specifically looking at the fact that there were both higher growth rates and lower average burn rates if you were outside one of the major tech hubs. So there's a couple slides that talk a little bit about this, but the main slide that I'm looking at here is slide 53. So on average, if you were outside of a major tech hub or in generally a low-cost region, your burn was $500,000 less per month, and your growth rate was 15% higher per annum than startups that were in high-cost regions. So, you know, being someone who invests primarily in low-cost regions, that slide in particular validates a lot about the thesis or a couple of theses that I work within. And that's kind of the key driver and why a lot of the investment decisions that our team makes, you know, we try to invest specifically in what we call underinvested in areas, but that likely are not New York, Boston, or Silicon Valley. Not that there's anything wrong with those areas domestically and a couple of other kind of very expensive places internationally. And we have done deals in most or all of those. But that being said, we try to stick with our relatively conservative kind of burn and growth expectation formula, both of which what's defined here as a low cost region, you know, falls much more in line with what our expectations are on both of those fronts. So those were kind of a couple of the key takeaways that I had. I thought there was really great information in here about success and growth rates as it relates to age of founders, and a lot of other really, really great insights throughout the entire rest of the report. But those were kind of a couple of high points, in my opinion, were again about having or building a product-led growth strategy to help improve your long-term growth trajectory, and exploring moving part or all of your team into lower-cost regions because you grow faster and burn less when you do that.
Yeah, and the last thing that I wanted to bring up is sort of calling back to a bunch of stuff that Graham, you and I have talked about in the past. Is the idea of, well, what is a tech company, or what is a company that merits like tech type valuation multiples? And I just wanted to draw everyone's attention to the to slide 44 of this presentation, which indicates that about 64%, so little less than 2/3 of responding companies had gross margins higher than 70%. And so whenever you see, companies that are looking to go public or maybe even are not going public, but are, seeking to raise money at valuations that would price them like a SaaS company, it's really important to ask yourself whether or not they actually are able to achieve SaaS type margins, which would in turn merit the lofty valuation that they're intending to seek.
That's a really good point. We've talked a lot in recent episodes about WeWork. That one obviously for sure comes to mind. I don't know what their gross margin is. I don't know if that was disclosed in any of the various versions of their S1. But my guess is it would not be above that 60 to 70% kind of minimum threshold. That probably a SaaS company would be defined by. Just go through every single insight in here, but a couple of other things to call out is I really liked the section, which was a couple of slides on account executives and expectations of how account executives based on the average size of customer. And so I thought it was really, really interesting to look at the way that on average these companies, manage people's books of businesses and target their salespeople's expectations of how much business they land. One of the insights was that account executives who target enterprise level customers, I think 1 in 3 have expectations of landing 7 figures a year of business. And then towards the very end of the report, before getting into the about the authors section, one of the other things that I think it's really interesting to pay attention to is there's one slide, that's slide 59, about gender equality. So just calling that out, because I know that, the venture, both investing world, but also the operating company side of things, probably for those who are more trying to be more socially conscious, should pay attention to that. And actually, the slide before, slide 58, is also about female-led companies. And interestingly enough, female-led companies with more than 50% of their leadership team being female raise less capital and perform better than male-led companies on average. So you grow faster while raising less outside capital, which was another kind of interesting insight, I thought.
Yeah, for sure. Just bringing it back to the question of WeWork and its gross margins. So Alex Wilhelm, my friend and the editor-in-chief at Crunchbase News, in August published an article that sort of finds that, well, it's WeWork was not exactly forthcoming when it talked about its gross margins. But if you wanted to look at a public comparison in IWG, which owns Regis, IWG reported revenue of, and they're UK based, of 1.3 billion pounds and a gross profit of 196.3 million pounds, working out to a gross margin of just over 15%. Extrapolating that methodology into the numbers disclosed in WeWork's S1, Alex writes, WeWork's H1 2018 results, revenue of $763.8 million, with location operating expenses of $636 million, which works out to an 83% of revenue consumed by location operating costs, which if you do a little bit of subtraction and all the rest, would result in a approximate 16.7% very rough calculation of gross margin for WeWork's H1 2018 results. So just wanted to share that, which is exactly why WeWork should not have been priced like a SaaS company. And similarly, any other company that is focused on primarily operations business and the wildly scaling costs of those, you know, should also temper their expectations of being able to raise with SaaS type multiples on for their valuations. So that was my last little that's my last little tidbit on this. Graham, was there anything else that you wanted to chat about today?
No, I don't know that I don't know that there was any more. Just call out a thank you to the folks over at OpenView Partners. Again, specifically for producing this report, that is yep. Kyle Poyer and Sean Fanning. Definitely great work, guys, and look forward to seeing many future versions.
Exactly. Graham, is this no longer the show?
Well, yeah, I think this may no longer be the show.
Okay.